This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It may sound improbable that the composer who wrote the big biblical music for the epic The Ten Commandments also wrote the sneaky, stylish music for the current crime film The Grifters. But my guest Elmer Bernstein did both. It shows his range and his longevity in the business. He's written about 200 other film scores. His music for the 1955 film The Man with the Golden Arm was one of the first jazz scores and paved the way for the many that followed. He also wrote music for Some Came Running, Walk on the Wild Side, To Kill a Mockingbird, and The Magnificent Seven, as well as the current film, The Field. Let's listen to some of the opening theme to The Grifters. Elmer Bernstein, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
We've just been listening to the opening credit music from one of the new films that you've written for, The Grifters. What did you want to express in the opening music for the film?
First of all, the thematic material itself is very odd. Its closest relation would be the kind of things that they were doing in Europe, particularly Germany in the early 30s. It brings to mind perhaps something like Three Penny Opera. It is sort of faintly decadent and faintly off-center, which sort of sets the whole atmosphere for the film itself.
The Grifters was produced by Martin Scorsese, directed by Stephen Frears. Who actually brought you on, and what did they tell you when they brought you on?
Well, you know, I've always had this theory, you know, that if you live long enough, everything comes around. Marty Scorsese, apparently, and it's a very nice thing to be able to say, although it sounds immodest, but Martin Scorsese has apparently been a fan of my music for some time and very, very well acquainted with the early films I did, and apparently particularly likes the score for a film I did in 1957, of all years, called The Sweet Smell of Success.
In a way, I think that The Grifters builds on some of your innovations from The Man with the Golden Arm, a movie that you scored in 1955, in the sense that it's a very urban music. It's a jazz-inspired music. Can we talk about 1955 for a minute?
We should, certainly.
Man with the Golden Arm was one of the first jazz-based scores, and I think it really set a trend off. It's the story stars, the movie starred Frank Sinatra as a jazz drummer and drug addict. So obviously it made sense to use a jazz score, but what else went behind the thinking of that?
Well, if we go back to The Man with the Golden Arm, it is precisely as you said. I mean, the atmosphere was Chicago. I mean, that's where it took place. Chicago is one of the great homes of early jazz. The main character in the film wanted to be a jazz drummer. And as a matter of fact, one of the crucial scenes in the film is when he goes to an audition as a drummer and tries to get himself a job. And that's where the idea of the jazz score grew. Jazz had been used before, more sparingly in scores. I think what made The Man with the Golden Arm seem special at the time was that the use of jazz was throughout the film, and a lot of the so-called scoring pieces, the dramatic background pieces, were also jazz-based. But the feeling for using jazz stemmed from the mise-en-scène and the main character.
Let me play some of the music you wrote from The Man with the Golden Arm, and then we'll talk more about the score.
Okay.
Okay.
Music from The Man with the Golden Arm, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. This was at the very beginning of the period when jazz ended up being used a lot for detective movies and TV shows and hard-boiled movies and TV shows.
I'm not so sure. You know, it depends on what you mean. The Man with the Golden Arm is 1955. In 1957, you get Peter Gunn, mm-hmm. which was Henry Mancini doing a score which was basically jazz-oriented. And then in 1958, a show called Staccato went on the air with John Cassavetes, also about a detective, for which I did the score, also jazz-oriented. So, I mean, I've had very mixed feelings about with The Man with the Golden Arm. Of course, I really cherish the memory of Man with the Golden Arm because it was actually the film that, so to speak, established my career. It did something else, which I have since regretted. Studios suddenly realizing how powerful the use of popular medium can be in a film score, because that hadn't been done in quite that way before. Not quite in the way I did in Man with the Golden Arm, not so thoroughly. And the effect of it, of course, was that the record album from the score was immensely successful. And it just sort of seemed to open up the floodgates, and from then on, score after score after score was using popular music of some kind, either jazz, and then finally it went to rock and roll scores. And unfortunately, a lot of this kind of music was used for its commercial value rather than its appropriateness to the dramatic action.
So what you're objecting to, finally, is using pop music to sell a movie or to sell soundtrack recordings from the movie. You're not objecting to using popular music itself, are you?
Oh, no, surely not. No, surely not. But I just think the shoe has to fit, you know, in a dramatic point of view. Some of these decisions, I think, are made, shall we say, less artistically. Very often a certain kind of score will be put in a movie because they think it's going to sell records, whether it's good for the dramatic action or not.
Well, just about the same time that you were writing The Man with the Golden Arm, you were also writing the score for The Ten Commandments, which I think is one of the great movie religious epics. What kind of music to you seemed appropriate for a religious epic? You certainly want it to be big. And, of course, in Ten Commandments, you had to have music that was not only behind Moses, but behind God, you know? This is a tall order.
Yes, but we forgot something even more important.
What, Cecil B. DeMille?
And that's Cecil B. DeMille. We'll never forget Cecil B. DeMille. Actually, DeMille was probably the most interesting experience in my whole life in the movie business, working with Cecil B. DeMille on that film. The music for the film was basically, the concept of the music was Wagnerian, because that's what DeMille wanted. When I say Wagnerian, DeMille's concept of the way music should work in a film was that each character should have a theme. And when the character is on the screen, that is what you use, their theme, every single time. If there are two characters on the screen, then you would then find some clever way of incorporating both of the themes. In that sense, it's very, well, that's what I mean by a Wagnerian concept.
Do you feel that eventually the religious epics ended up with a set of musical cliches?
Well, I could answer that in one word, yes. necessarily so. I mean, you know, I tell you who tried to break that, as a matter of fact, was once again Marty Scorsese and The Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, sure.
In which he used Peter Gabriel doing a lot of electronic music. I think, you know, it was very interesting about that. When we finished The Ten Commandments, the music of The Ten Commandments, and I'd gotten to the point of that time when I could address Mr. DeMille without saying, "Mr. DeMille, sir," and all that sort of thing. And I said to him, "Wouldn't you like to remake the picture about Christ?" He'd made a picture about Christ, Sign of the Cross, in the same period when he made the first Ten Commandments. And DeMille said to me, he was a very sort of knowledgeable person about the world and the body politic, so to speak. And DeMille said, "You know, I don't think you can make that kind of picture anymore in the atmosphere which exists in the world today." Because, you see, I think one of the problems is that that kind of picture is much easier to deal with in terms of the sensibilities and sensitivities of the public by sticking with the cliches, because which have grown up in the last 100 years, what we consider churchy music, for instance. Because I think if you don't do that, you then run the risk of somebody feeling that you're being sacrilegious. And DeMille sensed this, you know, that it would be very difficult to make that kind of a picture in this day and age. And I think, indeed, it is.
Let's listen to some of the music you wrote for the Exodus scene for the Ten Commandments. And
I can tell you a funny story about that after you listen to it.
Oh, swell. Okay. And I want to point out something obvious here, which is that it's the beginning starts off as if a shofar is blowing, right?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's pretty obvious. Here we go. This is
that's a funny story, too.
Okay. Well, we'll hear the stories after we hear the music. Okay. Music from the Exodus scene of the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Music from the Ten Commandments, composed by my guest, Elmer Bernstein. Okay, the funny stories.
Well, the first place, you know, when we realized that a shofar was going to be seen on the screen, we had to find somebody to play the shofar. Now, for those who don't know, the shofar is a very ancient instrument made out of a ram's horn. And it sounds very much like not very much, but something like a French horn, a brassy kind of sound. Anyway, where do you find people who play the shofar? Well, who plays shofars, of course, rabbis, because it's still used in Jewish ceremonies. Well, one day, DeMille got, we must have had, oh, I guess 20 or 30 rabbis on the on the scoring stage. And because we wanted to get different kinds of perspectives on the sound, we had them all over the scoring stage. playing these shofars. But the funny part was it was on a Friday, and we were getting dangerously close to twilight time, and we had to stop suddenly because, of course, all the rabbis have to stop working by sundown on Friday. So that was the shofar story. The story about the whole Exodus music is originally, I mean, in the Exodus, there were about 8,000 people in that scene. I don't know how many animals. There are about 8,000 people, and they move quite slowly, necessarily, as 8,000 people would, carrying their belongings with them. So I wrote a sort of very slow anthem-like processional. DeMille heard it; he hated it, and I said, "Well, what was wrong with that? I mean, it looks like the picture to me." He says, "That's the trouble. It looks like the picture, and the picture is too slow." He said, now I have to tell you that these 8,000 Hebrews in this scene were being played by 8,000 members of the Egyptian army, which is already pretty funny. And DeMille said, no, I want something with spirit. He said, something like Onward Christian Soldiers. And so finally we have that accounts for the way the Exodus sounds now. But it always seemed funny to me because it was terrifically ecumenical, because eventually what you have is 8,000 Egyptians playing Hebrews marching off to music like Onward Christian Soldiers.
That's terrific. Let's take a short break, and then we'll get back to a conversation with Elmer Bernstein about film music. This is Fresh Air. Film composer Elmer Bernstein is my guest. Let's get to another score that you wrote. This is such a great theme. I'm thinking of the theme from The Magnificent Seven, which was a Western epic based loosely on the Seven Samurai. Now, you wrote the theme for this. It was also a big pop hit. It was in the top 40, a version conducted by Al Caiola and his
yes,
orchestra.
Yes, Al Coyote did a sort of guitar arrangement of it.
Yeah, so was that good for you? Did you wish you had the hit?
No, I'm basically very unselfish that way. I'm funny about that. I don't like to see the attitudes of the music changed, and in that sense, the Al Coyola thing was very, very different. That bothered me a little bit. No, it didn't bother me that he had a hit because, I mean, obviously, it was very good for me. The best thing that ever happened from a purely economic point of view, that happened with the Magnificent Seven, is the theme was leased by a certain tobacco company.
We could say the name. People remember the Marlboro commercials with
right, the Marlboro commercial. And that's terribly funny. When I perform this piece at concerts, especially in Europe, where they still use those commercials, where they can still do those kinds of cigarette commercials, I can hear the whisper go through the audience. They hear it. And, of course, they know it better as the Marlboro thing.
Let's hear the theme that you wrote for The Magnificent Seven. Gosh, I love that music.
Thank you.
At what point do you see the footage? Do you like to see rushes from a movie before you even start thinking about what you're going
well,
to write?
Well, the great directors always have you involved right from the beginning. I mean, in the case, we're going back in The Man with Golden Arm, the case of the man with the Golden Arm, I was at the studio at the very first time the cast sat down around a table and read from the script the play. Marty Scorsese, for instance, for whom I'm doing a film, is shooting a film in Florida. We had a chat on the phone the other night. Now, Marty, who's, I think, one of the geniuses of our field, Marty wants me to come down to Florida, for instance, to see some stuff. You know, while it's a work in progress, great directors generally will do this, and they generally not only want the composer there, but really enjoy the composer's input.
What do you do if a film is re-edited and suddenly the music isn't going to work because the length
Boy,
of the scenes has been changed?
You know how to ask the right questions. I tell you, you know what you do? You suffer a lot, a great deal. An edit can be very, very painful because it's not just a question of cutting a bar here, cutting a bar there. Hopefully you get a chance to rewrite it. And then re-record it. Now, I mean, all sorts of odd things happen. I mean, going back to The Grifters again, I enjoyed very much working with Stephen Frears. During the creative period, he came up to my studio in London, and we played things for him on electronic devices, synthesizers, so he could hear what the score was going to be like. And the recording was absolutely delightful and thrilling and exciting. Interestingly enough, when Stephen ran the picture a couple of times, he decided that he really wanted to change the character, really of the film was what he was playing with, and took the score as it existed, didn't change any of the music, or the music's all there, except he used some of the music more than was originally intended, and moved all the music around in the picture, which not in the way we'd originally designed it. I thought to myself, my goodness, this isn't, never going to work. Well, and I didn't see what he had done. And then the picture started to be shown, and people would call me and say, gee, the music was really effective in that film. I think to myself, my goodness, what's really happened here? I dare say, here's a case where the composer and the director would have done very, very different kinds of things with the music. Now, I don't know why Stephen felt the way he did, but it is possible that ultimately we wound up with very different views of the film. But interestingly enough, he could still use all the same music. It's just in different places.
Well, Elmer Bernstein, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music.
Thank you.
My guest has been composer Elmer Bernstein. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.